If you want to join me in God's Word this morning, we'll be in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 8. All right, we've taken a few weeks off from our ongoing study through the Gospel of Matthew. We're returning there today. It's a long study. We're some 112 studies into Matthew now. And we are recently finished with our study through the Sermon on the Mount, which occupied our attention and focus for about 3 years. And now we're moving into the next section. We've done two studies already in this next section, or actually three, and we're continuing that study. This is in chapters 8 and 9. These two chapters that immediately follow the Sermon on the Mount chapters are functioning in a particular way as Matthew is telling the story of Jesus bringing God's kingdom into this fallen world. The two chapters here in this section, chapters 8 and 9, are really a sequence of stories about special healings and special miracles that Jesus did in his ministry. They are intentionally aimed at demonstrating the end statement, the concluding statement in the Sermon on the Mount. And let's just reread that concluding statement at the end of chapter 7. And all that we're studying in chapter 8 and chapter 9 is really linked to this intentionally by Matthew. I'm reading from verse 28 now of chapter 7. It says, "And when Jesus finished these sayings," the sayings being the Sermon on the Mount sayings, "the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes." And then that flows into the accounts of the various healings and ministries in chapter 8 and chapter 9. All of these healings, all of these miracles are demonstrating the authority that Jesus had. And it wasn't just the normal kind of authority that was given by social agreement that, wow, we think this person is a good teacher, we're interested in hearing what they have to say. What's being declared by Matthew in the account and the way that it's constructed is that this is a much higher authority. This is ultimate authority. This is the one who speaks with the authority as the Son of God. Now, in these miracles and healings that we've studied so far, we've seen there's two significant healings that he's done. One, he cleansed a leper in the first four verses of chapter 8. Then in our previous study, verses 5 through 14, he healed at a distance the servant of a centurion, a Roman centurion. And what we identified, we looked at the details of the actual healing and the blessing that these people experienced and took encouragement for our own hearts about the Lord's compassion, the Lord's mercy that's being shown, and the Lord's power that's being displayed. But we also developed an important point that I want us to remember as we move forward in these chapters. And that's that all of the miracles and all of the healings, all of the special, powerful works that Jesus does are also, not only this, but they're also symbolic. Meaning they're all messages. Just like the Sermon on the Mount was a message, but it was a message in words. Now these works of the Lord, these miracles and healings are a message from the Lord, but they're a message in the things that he does, not just the things that he says. And they're communicating things to us about the kingdom. They're communicating things to us about our condition, spiritually speaking. For instance, like when we studied the healing of the leper, we saw that leprosy, biblically speaking, all the way back to the Old Testament law, was revealed as a symbol of the impact and the effect of sin on humanity. It's functioning as kind of a living parable to show us how sin has affected our lives. And as Jesus comes and heals the leper, as he touches the leper, as he restores the leper, it's a declaration to us of the Savior's ability to restore our lives from the ravages of sin as it has affected all of us. Now, we're moving into a new section here, or a new portion of this sequence of miracles and healings, and that's in verses 14 through 17. And there's one particular healing that's highlighted first, in which Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law. And then that's going to transition into Jesus healing a multitude of people, which is, we're going to see as kind of a summary description in real events of this, kind of summing up this sequence of three healings that are highlighted for us at the beginning of this chapter. So let's read verses 14 through 17 and address the details of what is focused on for us here. Matthew 8:14. When Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. That evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. Now, I do want to get to the healing events, and I do certainly want to get to the significance and the meaning of those healings. But before we get even that far, this passage introduces and actually makes a point for our benefit, for our perspective's benefit, that was not originally intended as Matthew wrote it, meaning that there's a point that we should notice, we should recognize in this passage, that as Matthew was writing it, he was not thinking of what I'm about to say. But it doesn't mean that this point is not valid and is not important for us to notice. It's just because the issue that I'm going to address didn't even exist as Matthew was writing this. It's an issue in history that developed later, but it teaches us something that applies to that issue. And what I'm talking about is the relationship that's described for us between Peter and his family. Reading again in verse 14, when Jesus entered Peter's house, by the way, this location was in the city of Capernaum, and we know at this time, as I described in our previous studies in chapter 8, Jesus had moved from the city of Nazareth down to the larger city of Capernaum, which is on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. And Peter has apparently moved there as well. His family has moved there with him. And Jesus is renting, as one of the other Gospels tells us, his own house. And Peter is living in his house. And so when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. All right, first thing I want us to notice then, before we get to the healing section, is this interesting detail from just a brief family circumstance description in the passage, and that is that Peter had a mother-in-law, which implies what? Peter was married. And literally in the original text, we use mother-in-law just because that's our way of describing this special relationship. But in the original text, it's literally Peter's wife's mother is being described here. Peter's wife's mother. It's, for us, we just have a different way of describing that relational situation. So Peter was married. No big deal, hopefully, for most of you. But if any of you have ever had any kind of exposure in your personal past to Roman Catholicism and the teachings of Roman Catholicism, it may be a big deal and it may be significant. It's certainly worth for us stopping for a moment and understanding the implications of this passage. Let's turn to another one, and we'll keep our place here because we're certainly coming back to Matthew. Let's look at a second New Testament passage that addresses this same issue. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. This is also brief, but this is Paul's description of Peter and Peter's family circumstance. And it's in the context here, I won't read the whole context, but it's in the context of Paul talking about his own circumstance as a traveling apostle. And he's comparing himself here. He uses the name in this section that I'm going to read, Cephas, C-E-P-H-A-S. Cephas is the Aramaic form of the name Peter. All right. So let's read from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 3. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife? What he's talking about is taking along in apostolic journeys. He's saying, don't I have the right to be, in a sense, fed by the ministry that I'm doing? Don't I have a right to take along a wife? He's not making that case because Paul himself is married, but he's saying, look, this is the normal case for apostles, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas. Cephas here, as I mentioned, is an Aramaic reference to Peter. So we have two New Testament passages that clearly imply and describe that Peter was married. Now, Paul writes this sometime after Matthew's account of what happened in Capernaum as Jesus entered Peter's house that day. So we know Peter was still married at the time that Paul was writing his letter to the Corinthians. Now, why is this significant? As I mentioned, it's really only significant due to over 1,500 years now of Roman Catholic influence. The Catholics consider Peter to be whom? The first pope of the Christian church, specifically the Roman Catholic church. I'm not going to make this teaching today a whole thing about Catholicism and certainly not a whole thing about the Pope, but I hope you all know and understand by now that from a biblical perspective, there is no such thing as a Pope, right? I mean, you look all the way through the Old Testament, you look all the way through the New Testament, the concept of Pope as a role of leadership within the Christian community, within the Christian church, is an invention of Roman Catholic tradition and doctrine. It's not a biblical concept. There is no Bible Pope, right? We're all on the same page with that. But the Catholic Church has established that concept. They have argued for over 1,500 years now of church history that the Lord intended for there to be one individual in charge of all Christian churches, kind of like a corporate president or head of all Christianity, and that individual is identified by them as the Vicar of Christ, meaning their concept is that he is the chosen representative in every generation. And of course, as popes die and new popes are appointed, each one entering into this role, he is supposed to be the singular greatest representation of Christ himself on earth. Now, one of the things in terms of how this passage applies to this is that according to Catholic doctrine and Catholic tradition, popes are not allowed to marry. And not just popes, but all Roman Catholic priests are not allowed to marry. And the question is whether or not that's a biblical concept or a biblical principle, or whether we should understand that in the same way we understand why they have chosen to name this position of Pope to begin with. Is it biblical? Is it truly something the Lord intends for his church and for the leadership of his church? Or is this something that was added later through tradition and the doctrines of man as an incrustation on top of the core of what God has revealed as truth in the scriptures and his purposes and his principles for his people to follow as Christians and as churches? And the truth is that if Peter's the first pope, and he is according to their doctrine, not according to mine, but based upon their inference that Peter was the first pope, we should take Peter as then the example of what popes are supposed to do and how they're supposed to live and what their life is supposed to look like. And we see that their concept that popes are not to be married and leaders in the Christian community are not to be married is absolutely not a biblical principle whatsoever. All right, so like I said, I don't want to make that the whole focus of our study today, and it's certainly not what Matthew had in mind as he was writing this section, but because of early Catholic tradition, I think it's worth us stopping and noticing it. All right, let's move on to the actual, and by the way, let me just say this. This is just one of the reasons that we are called by the Lord to study Scripture as carefully as we do, to notice even the details, these little details that just seem to be like background information to the main story, but those elements are added for our benefit and for reasons that inform us not just for the main point of the story, but inform our perspective for all kinds of different aspects of our Christian life. All right, so let's move on then, as I said, to the main story of the actual healings that are identified here in this section. It says when Jesus, back in Matthew 8:14, when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. The word lying here is an interesting Greek word which means to throw down. And the idea is that this was not just a mild fever that was affecting a little bit how Peter's mother-in-law was feeling that day. This was a fever that hit her hard. And in the very vivid description that Matthew uses, this fever literally threw her down. So she was lying sick, having been thrown down by the force of this fever affecting her physical well-being. We won't turn and read it, but there are parallel accounts of this same healing event in the Gospels of Mark and in the Gospel of Luke. And Luke's description is even more descriptive for us because, as you know, Luke was a physician, and he adds one additional detail. He describes her fever as what we would call a high fever now. But it's really a descriptive term. The word for fever in the original text means to be on fire. And we even use that kind of description. You know, if you're describing a high fever to someone else, we say even today, it's like I'm on fire. You know, they're burning up with fever. And that's literally how Luke describes the fever that Peter's mother-in-law was experiencing. So Jesus enters Peter's house. He sees the mother-in-law thrown down, impacted greatly, burning up with a high fever. And he does something very simple. He doesn't make a big show of it. He doesn't, you know, call for the TV cameras to come in and record what he's doing. He just simply walks over to where she's lying down. We know he walks over there because the result is he touches her. He touches her in a specific location. We don't know which one, but he touched her hand. And as soon as he touches her hand, the fever left her. What I want us to catch, though, and we would only know this if we knew a little bit of the background of the culture and the society of that day, when Jesus touched her hand, and I mentioned something similar to this, and I think the theme is running throughout this chapter on purpose. In fact, this actually applies to the two previous healings that we studied. Jesus crosses social boundaries when he does this simple act of walking over to Peter's mother-in-law and touches her hand. It's certainly a compassionate and merciful thing that he does by touching her to heal her. But he's really breaking the rules when he does this, just like he did with the leper. Remember what the rule was when he healed the leper? He could have healed the leper with a word, as we saw in our study. He had the power, like he did with the centurion servant, to heal at a distance, to heal with only a word. But with the leper, he intentionally crossed the line and he touched the leper. What was the rule that he was breaking? Socially and even spiritually / socially, he was breaking a rule because lepers were not to be touched. It was a great concern. They believed that leprosy was able to be transmitted from one person to another by touch. And so they isolated lepers. They made sure there was no physical contact between lepers and other individuals in the community, because if one person touches that leper and then touches others, it would spread through the community. And so when Jesus touched the leper, instead of the leprosy jumping from the leper to Jesus, the healing power of God jumped from Jesus to the leper, healed him, restored him, transformed his physical circumstance. But in order to do that, he broke the rule. He crossed a line that those watching him would have said, hey, don't do that. That's wrong. That's not wise. That's not smart. And in healing the centurion servant, he crossed a different kind of line, a different kind of social boundary. What was that? He helped a Roman. Remember that we saw in our last study, it's been a while, a few weeks, but we saw that that was a big social Jewish faux pas. He really blew it because the Jews hated the Romans. They hated the Romans because the Romans were their conquerors. The Romans were occupying their land. They were under the Roman boot, so to speak. And they didn't enjoy that. They didn't like it. And they didn't want any Jewish person to do any good thing for any Roman person. And he heals the Roman centurion who is in charge of the local army that's occupying Israel. It's like, why would you do that? And yet Jesus is demonstrating that his ministry is not just exclusively for Jews alone. His ministry is ultimately going to bless the entire Gentile world as well. And so he heals the centurion servant, but breaks a social boundary when he does so. Well, this healing, as simple as it is in healing Peter's mother-in-law, breaks a social boundary. It's actually two of them. And this was from the tradition of the Pharisees. The Pharisees had two traditions that Jesus broke at the same time. One is, don't ever touch a woman. If you were a Pharisee in good standing and you were ever found to publicly, you know, in the view of anyone else, touch a woman other than your wife in private, you would be automatically losing your status as a Pharisee. It was considered to be a major violation of Pharisaical protocol. Don't ever touch a woman. Now, of course, Jesus didn't touch her inappropriately. He touched her on her hand, you know, very compassionate, you know, very, very mercifully. But nevertheless, it broke the Pharisees' social guidelines. The second guideline they had is don't ever touch anyone who was fevered. Because just like leprosy, they believed that the fever was itself the disease and not just a symptom of a disease. We understand medically nowadays that fevers happen because of something else that's going on inside the body. But their perspective and understanding was that the fever was itself the disease, and that if you touched a fevered person, that fever could jump off of them and jump onto you. And so in both cases, he did something that other Pharisees, looking at him, observing what he was doing, noticing the simple act of him touching her hand, he would be, in essence, making himself unclean in their perspective. And that tells us, just like with the leper, just like with his ministry to the centurion and the centurion servant, that Jesus is not terribly concerned with social niceties here. He's got deeper priorities. He's got something more important going on in his heart and in his concerns. He's concerned to minister to her real need. And he's willing to risk being misunderstood by the society around him in order to show the compassion of God and to show the power of God in her life. Now, he does touch her, and we're not given a long and detailed description, but the simplicity of the description kind of highlights, like spotlights, the power of the Lord in this circumstance. Verse 15, he touched her hand, and the fever left her. And she rose and began to serve him. The clear implication, and one of the other Gospels actually adds this term, and the term is immediately. The clear implication is that as soon as Jesus touched her hand, she was healed. Now, let's keep in mind what she was healed of. She was healed of a fever that was so intense that it threw her down on a sickbed. It was a high fever. It was a burning on fire fever. We don't know the exact temperature. Was it a 100? I mean, I don't think it was a temperature of 100. You know how it is? I've had temperatures of 100. I didn't feel great, but, you know, I could still function. But how many of you have ever had a temperature of 104 or 105? You know, it's not common, and I'm thankful that I haven't had this experience too often, but I have had that high of a temperature, and the times that I've had that high of a temperature, I literally did not want to get out of bed. I just felt like my life was coming to an end. It was just like, Lord, just kill me now. You know, I'd rather be in heaven. It's just a horrific kind of debilitating experience. The point is, though, eventually, you know, as long as you don't die from that high of a fever, and it can be somewhat risky to get that high, if you don't die, you eventually recuperate. You eventually recover. I know some folks here have recently had a high fever because of this flu bug that's going around. How long does it normally take if you've had that high of a fever to recuperate to where you feel like I'm ready to get up out of bed and function at 100% capacity with my normal responsibilities? I'm sorry. We got a nurse on hand here. Help. Yeah. 3 days. Okay. And I know I've talked to a couple of you that have had a high fever, and a week later, 2 weeks later, in one case, I was talking to, one of the sisters earlier today. It's a month, 2 months later, and she's still not feeling 100%. She is at least functioning now, but still not feeling 100%. What I want us to notice from this, it's very simple description, but it's powerful in its implications. He touched her hand and the fever left her. Not the fever started to subside. Not that the fever started to go down from whatever it might have been, 104, 105, something burning down slowly. You know, now it's 103, a couple hours later, 102, you know, down to 98, 3 days later. As soon as he touched her, the fever was gone. And as soon as it was gone, she was 100% healthy. And she immediately got up and began to do what it would be normal for her to do, which was to minister to the guest in her house. She had a special guest. Can you imagine? Jesus has come over for dinner. She wants to get up and fix him some food. And so she does. She rose and began to serve him. So it's a very short, simple story, but beautiful in its implication, showing the power of the Lord over this burning fever that this woman had and his willingness to cross even normal social boundaries in order to show her this demonstration. And not just her, but showing Peter, his disciple, showing the others that were with them, because one of the other Gospels tell us that in this event, Peter and his brother Andrew were both present, and John and James, two of the other apostles, were also in the house at the time that he healed her, showing all of the disciples as well how gracious and powerful he was in his relationship to this circumstance. All right, that leads us then to the rest of the account in verse 16. That evening, and the reason it took until evening is this is during the time of the Sabbath, and people would appropriately wait until the evening when the Sabbath had passed in order to do this. That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons. One of the other Gospels describes it as there was a large crowd that gathered at the front door of Peter's house. Somehow word had spread that he was in town and that he was at Peter's house, and they brought a multitude of people to him, a large number of people. And these people were suffering in two different ways, and he responded to both of their legitimate needs. One group was, as it says at the very end, and just understand these are two different concerns here. At the end of verse 16, he healed all who were sick. So in healing the multitude, he healed the sick people that were there, and he healed all of them. Which is just simply, you know, a detail for us to notice. It's not like if you go to, there are various Christian ministries that portray themselves as healing evangelists. And you can go to a special healing meeting and people come up on stage and they'll pray for them and they'll make, usually Most of these guys will make a big show of it. And if you bother to check with the people that have been prayed for after the meeting is over, after the hoopla has subsided, what you'll notice and what you'll discover is that on occasion you will encounter someone that has been healed by the Lord, because I believe the Lord is just gracious to heal people in spite of the show that some of his servants make out of all of this. But you'll also encounter a lot of people that have gone up and been prayed for and were not healed at all. But when the Son of God ministers to the sick, they're healed, and all of them are healed. There's no discrimination. There's no distinguishing. He meets the need. Now, the second category, though, is introduced first, and that is, that evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons. So there is a physical issue from some, and they're sick, and then there's a spiritual issue for others, and that's a demon issue. Now, what that should raise for us, and I don't think it's a big problem for those of us that are here in the room today, but part of what we do when we study is not just to kind of rehearse what we already believe for our own sake, but we also discuss issues to better equip us to interact with an unbelieving culture around us. It raises the issue for us in the culture in which we live today, this simple question: do demons exist? Is there such a thing really? Because you know how it is in our culture tends to respond to this concept and this question two different ways, and they're fairly different in the approach. Part of our culture just says, that's ridiculous. There is no such thing as demons. That's simply a very primitive religious mythology from an ancient world that didn't know any better. And, you know, it's so ridiculous that people believe that there is such a thing as demonic spirits. So that's one group from our culture. There's another group from our culture, even today, that very much believe in the existence and the reality of demons, but do so in kind of like, and I hope you haven't seen these movies, but kind of like the horror movie, you know, portraying the activity of demons as though they're these super-powered entities that just at a whim move in to circumstances in people's lives and just overwhelm them with their far superior power and a sinister wickedness. So you have both of those things portrayed and held to in our culture today. And neither of those are biblical, and neither of those are true. The truth is something in between those two extremes. The Bible clearly teaches, without debate, it's never even raised as, I wonder if this is true, let's discuss this, let's debate this, let's consider two sides of the story kind of thing. The Bible simply declares the real existence of demonic beings. Now, what are demons? Well, without, again, turning the entire teaching into a teaching about the background of demons, we'll just say that demons are evil spirit beings. They have reality and they have substance, but their substance is spiritual in nature, not physical in nature. They are not physical, but they have an ability to interact with the physical world in which we live out our lives. The nature of that interaction, you know, would require a complete study or more dedicated to that subject. But I'm not debating it this morning. I'm just wanting to introduce the concept and to just assert, like the Bible clearly does, demons exist. They're real. They have spiritual substance and reality. Their nature is they're inclined to evil, and all of their activities are expressions of evil. They're spiritual in nature, and they are real personalities. Okay? Now, in this circumstance, what we see simply described is that evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons. This, I think it would help for me to identify the three Bible descriptions of demonic influence that a person can experience in their life. And just to be clear, I'm saying that a person can experience. That does not mean that every human being is under demonic influence. Many are, actually. And I'll describe the different ways and layers of that influence. But just because demons exist, and just because they are evil, and just because they are attempting to influence people in the world, doesn't mean that everybody automatically is, as some well-meaning but poorly informed Christian teachers insist. So the three layers of influence are, I'm going to use the term for the first layer, one, and that is simply influence. The second, I'll give you a passage to connect with each of these. The second is what I'm going to call oppression. And the third I'm going to call demonization, which corresponds to the classic concept of possession. And I'll explain each one of these. First, let's look at a passage that describes influence. And we'll come back to Matthew, but 1 Timothy chapter 4. Each one of these three points, you know, we could spend an entire teaching time focused on this. I just want to introduce the concept to you, though. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1. Paul teaches, now the Spirit, he's speaking of the Holy Spirit here. The Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Paul identifies that there is such a thing as teaching of demons. Now, when a person, and I speak this from experience, when a person teaches another person, you are influencing them. I'm influencing you this morning by my teaching. Interestingly here, though, this is described as the teaching of demons. Does that mean that in some church settings and other spiritual and religious gatherings that demons literally appear and stand behind a podium and begin to speak to the gathered crowd and that's the way that people are influenced by the teaching of demons? No, the idea is whoever is the teacher comes under the influence of demons themselves. And then when they open their mouth, they're speaking concepts that represent the thoughts and the perspectives of demons rather than the truth. It's kind of like that moment in Peter's experience later in the gospel when Peter says to Jesus, Jesus had just told him, I'm heading for the city of Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be put on trial. I'm going to be falsely convicted. Then I'm going to be crucified. And Peter says what to Jesus? Nah, no way. That should never happen to you. You're the Messiah. Far be it from you to go through that. And Jesus says in response to Peter what? Get behind me, Satan. He's not saying that Peter had suddenly become demon possessed by Satan himself. He's saying that Peter's perspective had been influenced by a demonic perspective. And that Peter was parroting that perspective by saying to trying to re-influence Jesus not to go that direction when that direction really was the direction of God. And so when people believe the influence of demons or the teachings of demons, they come under demonic influence. This is a subtle effect of demons. You can be under demonic influence and not even know you're under demonic influence if you're believing a doctrine that a demon has taught. For instance, the entire Roman Catholic Church believes that popes and priests should not be married. And this very passage identifies for us that that's a demonic teaching. It's a teaching of demons to forbid marriage by any of God's people. And certainly that absolutely applies to the leaders of God's people. Now, the second level is a greater level. This is a progressive effect of demon influence in the life of an individual. Oppression, let's look at a passage in Ephesians chapter 2. Years ago, when we studied through Ephesians, we camped out and spent some time here. So I won't spend a lot of time on this, and we're coming to the end of our study time anyway. But let me read Ephesians 2, verses 1 through 3, which describes, I believe, a greater influence through an oppressive kind of effect that people experience in this world. Paul writes, "And you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world." Course of this world describes, it's a description of a river that's flowing. It's like we're all, everyone in this world is caught up in a river and is flowing along in the current of that river, the effect and the influence of that river upon them, bearing them down a particular pathway. "In which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air." Now, who is that personage? We're talking about Satan himself, but this is absolutely applicable to all the demons that are under his authority. "Following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience." Sons of disobedience is every human being that's set in their heart in rebellion against God and against his authority. "Among whom we once all lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind." All right, so this describes not just a teaching influence, but an influence upon behavior. It's still subtle in the sense that it's coming from the outside in, but it's affecting the way people live their lives and the choices that they make that lead them into sinfully, progressively worse behaviors. Now, the final category, I said it's demonization, the more traditional word that we're familiar with is possession. I'm calling it demonization because in all of the biblical accounts of someone being encountered who is described as being possessed by a demon, the Greek word that's used to describe that literally is demonization. It describes such a direct contact and influence of the demon to that person that the demon is no longer influencing that person from the outside in, like in these first two categories, but the demon has in some mysterious way literally moved into the same physical body as the person that's living their life in that body. The demon literally co-inhabits the same physical body as the person who is demonized. Now, this passage that we're studying here is just one of many gospel accounts, and we have accounts also in the book of Acts, of course, of this type of circumstance. So let's read, going back to Matthew 8, this account of a demonization, and not just one individual demonized, but a number of people. It says in verse 16, and now let me clear up a potential point of confusion in the description here. "That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons." Now, I chose to use the word oppression as my second category, saying it's influence, demon influence from the outside in, not the inside out. But the word that's actually translated oppressed is the Greek word for demonization that describes actual possession. So it's just, to me, it's not the best translation, because the Bible does use the term oppressed in other places to describe the outside-in influence of demons. This event in Matthew 8 is not describing that. It's describing the inside-out influence, where demons, in the case of some of these in this crowd that were brought to the home of Peter for Jesus to minister to them, some of them were actually inhabited by demons living in their physical body. And just so you know, thankfully, none of you are in that circumstance today. But a person who is in that circumstance, it is a dominating effect on that person. This is not just someone that is, you know, normal and ordinary And then, oh, I didn't know there was a demon living in them all that time. It's something much more serious than that. It's like the individual that we see in a later account where, you know, he's described as having a legion of demons living inside him, and he's living in the tombs, and he's cutting himself, and he's what we would call, just by bare observation, a crazy person. You know, in my earlier time in the Lord, when I was younger in the Lord years ago, before they closed it, I volunteered on a regular basis at what was known then as Camarillo Mental Institution. I went in for Christian ministry purposes, but I can testify that there is such a thing still to this day of people having demons inhabit their body, and our culture only views it and perceives it as crazy people. But it's something much deeper and darker than just a mental issue for some of them. We're talking about an actual entity that is controlling that individual's behavior. So this is what happens. That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons. Literally, many who were possessed. Many who were demonized. And what did he do? He cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. I love the description here. There's a very vivid account. For the sake of our time, we won't turn and read it, but I'll just give you the reference point if you want to look it up in your own time. Acts chapter 19, verses 13 through 17. It's the story of what are identified as the seven sons of Sceva. They were called itinerant Jewish exorcists. It was actually a career at that time and in this culture where people took it upon themselves to try to cast demons out of people. They didn't have the authority to do so. They didn't have the power to do so. But they went through all kinds of magical incantations. And they would do certain specific things. They would burn special herbs. And they would do all of these magical type things to try to get people who were demonized to be released by the demons that were possessing them. And as the seven sons of Sceva attempted to cast out demons by calling on the name of Jesus, whom they had heard that Paul the Apostle was preaching, the demon didn't come out of the demonized person. The demon did what? Used that person's body to beat up all seven of the sons of Sceva, to literally assault them. And the idea here is that as Jesus encountered not just one demonized individual, but many demonized individuals. He didn't go through any, you know, incantations. He didn't do anything magical. He spoke a word to each one. And as we understand from the other accounts of him ministering to those who were demonized, this had to have been a word of authority. Because that's the point of this entire section. Demonstrating the authority that Jesus had to teach what he taught in the Sermon on the Mount. The authority to heal every disease, the authority over the spirit beings that are set in an evil rebellion against the purposes of God. He, as Lord, has 100% authority over them. He spoke a word and the demons left. They didn't want to leave. Other passages tell us that when a demon leaves an individual, they immediately seek to gain reentry to that individual, if they're allowed to do so. He spoke a word and the demons were required to leave. They're in rebellion, but they remain under the Lord's authority. They don't have a choice to do what they want, when they want, how they want to do it. They are under the authority of the Lord of heaven and earth. And all of this demonstrating to us this sequence of healings and this ministry to those who are specially possessed or demonized, that he is the Lord who has the authority to teach the things that he teaches to us. All right, now I'm going to save verse 17 as a transition into the remainder of the next section, but I'll address that, Lord willing, in our next study 2 weeks from today. As a reminder, next week, home church study, as we're going to be studying together the 10 tests that the Lord took Abraham through, the 10 tests of faith that he took Israel through. God bless you this morning, and we'll look forward to seeing you in home church next week.